And, well, thank you. My name is Russell. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a member of the Carl Gables Group. It's good to be here. It's good to be back. I missed you guys. I really did. And that's a blessing to, you know, these small little things that we don't even think about. You know, I haven't found it necessary to have a drink since January 25th, 1981. And, you know, you get used to these things. These are little things, missing people. You know, I never used to miss people. I used to feel sorry for myself. I was a self-pity holic. I used to feel sorry for myself a lot, you know, which is different than missing people. You know, the Apostle Paul in Corinthians says, it says, worldly sorrow, which I perceive as being self-pity, leads only to death. And I'll tell you, if you've ever been involved in self-pity, you might as well be dead. It's like being dead to the world. But godly sorrow, being sorry for what you have become, and God leads to repentance and leads to salvation, leads to life. And there's a big difference between feeling sorry for yourself because you're alone or somebody's gone, and just the pure feeling of missing people because you love them. And I'm not sure I even knew what love was until I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and had the ability to love people and care about them and actually learn to love myself. You know, and you know, the ability to actually worry about how people are doing. And I don't want to say worry even in a bad way. Just think about, you know, how people are doing. And being concerned with people. Concerned about how they're doing. Concerned about helping people. Because anytime I was concerned about anything in this world, it was always masquerading or hiding, really being worried about myself. You know, I remember I was dating a gal when I was going to the University of Miami. I was young, you know, about 19 years old or something like that. And I met a gal named Lynn from New Jersey, and I fell in love. Well, I fell in love with every gal I met. I fell in love with gals I didn't meet. You know, I was just constantly falling in love, and that's just the nature of being an alcoholic. You're a hopeless romantic, and things don't, you know, you always squeeze people to death, you know, and they're never well enough to comply with everything you need because you're so needy. But in any event, this gal came from New Jersey, and her parents, like a lot of people in college, were supporting her. And so she was with me. We had that like alcoholic type of love, you know, where like, you know, you're like sucking each other's brains out, you know, like you're with each other every day, every night, every minute, you know. I mean, I guess if they had texting back then, I'd be texting her all the time and everything, always thinking about her, and for the whole year. And then around Christmas time, she says to me, she says, you know, my parents, who, by the way, had been paying the bills, would like me to come home for a week to be with them on Christmas. And I looked at her. I said, I was like astonished. I said, because I was in love, you know what I mean? And, you know, this is what I said. I said, but what about me? That's what I said, but what about me? I knew nothing about love. You scratch the surface of love, and it's always, what about me? And, of course, she said, you know, her parents hadn't seen her in a year, and she wanted to see her parents, but what about me? And so she flew up to see her parents, and of course, like a good alcoholic, I flew up after her. You know, I was a stalker in the making. You know? Hi, guess where I am? Right around the corner. Stalking you. See, I didn't need alcohol to be crazy. You know, most alcoholics really don't. You know, I suffer from alcoholism, which continues after you stop drinking, by the way. That's why we continue to go to drink meetings, because the alcohol is a symptom of the disease. My real disease centers in my mind, not my body, and things of that nature. So, I mean, I want to talk about step nine tonight, a little bit about step nine, and maybe a different type of way, making direct amends, being reconciled. I was talking to Pastor Miller tonight about being reconciled to God, being reconciled to man, being reconciled to our, you know, the God of our understanding, and being able to have a relationship, you know, with Him. And then, as a result of that, experience some unbelievable stuff that I want to talk about. And that's what I really want to talk about. I want to talk about the miracle. that may happen to you, or is the miracle that's available to you, if you don't want, I want you to know that this deal exists. I want you to know when you go to AA meetings, I know a lot of you know that if you go to AA, you stop drinking. That's available to you. But I want to let you know, although there's nothing wrong with stopping drinking, it's a big deal and everything, is if all you get out of AA is stopping drinking, you are like selling yourself short. It's like going to a banquet, an incredible banquet, where they have every incredible food in the world, and you like walk out with like a ham sandwich. And there's a guy there with like lobster, you know, and steak. And you say, where'd you get that? He says, well, they had it in the back room. Didn't you go back there? He said, I only saw the ham sandwich. You know, it says our real purpose here, after the ninth step, is to fit ourselves to be a maximum service to God and to the people about us. You know, and I'll tell you, the greatest way to be of maximum service to God is just to have him living in your heart, you know, and having a relationship with him. It says see to it that your relationship with him is right. Great events will come to pass for you and countless others. You know, I'll tell you what, I don't know about you, but when I first came in here, I wanted not to drink so badly. I was so scared about drinking that I would have been perfectly satisfied with the not drinking club. The not drink. But you know, after about 2 or 3 weeks, 4 or 5 weeks, you know, I was looking around for something else. I don't think I would have ever stayed sober to good purpose and been able to experience what I experience now if the only thing I was after in here was not drinking. And I don't know what it is, but apparently some people come in here and all they see is a not drinking club. That's all they see. And some people come in here and they see something altogether different. And I'm just grateful, and it has nothing to do with being smart or anything like that, that I noticed that there was some different things going on in here. And that's what I want to talk about. I want to talk about, you know, there's a part of the big book that says, this is what it says, it says, We have experienced much of heaven, and we have been rocketed into the fourth dimension of existence of which we had not even dreamed. Now I want you to think about something for a second. Is that true for you? I mean, I know you're sober a year or two or 15 days or 20 years or 30 years. Are you experiencing much of heaven, and have you been rocketed into the fourth dimension of existence of which you had not even dreamed? Is that happening to you consistently on a daily basis? I'm not talking about once in a while you feel good or you're having a good day or, you know, really something great happened to you yesterday. Are you on a consistent basis experiencing much of heaven and being rocketed into the fourth dimension of existence of which you would not even dream? Because if that ain't happening to you, I tell you something, you're not realizing the true promise of what AA can do for you. You know, I don't want you walking out of here and say and thinking for 1 second they wrote a book about not drinking and all that other stuff is a bunch of bull. That's just sort of pie in the sky stuff, but nobody ever experienced, you know. I don't want you to think that they told you the truth about all the not drinking stuff. But all that stuff of, you know, having knowing a new freedom and a new happiness, losing fear of people and of economic insecurity, you know, all that other stuff they're talking about was just a bunch of junk, and it never really happened, and they're just pulling your leg. I want you to know that they talked about their experience, what was really going on, and that there are other people experiencing this, and that this is available for you. You know, and I know not everybody wants this stuff for whatever reason. You know, it's not for me to force this on people. You know, I was, you know, I tell this story because it so impressed me once. It's funny how this thing works. I was in a Bible study one day, and I heard this story, and it was just so impressive, the story. And I went back, and I looked it up on the internet, and I looked it up in the insect, and it was true. I found out it was true. You know, the guy said it was true, but, you know, I like to check it out on Scopes and everything like that. And it was true, and I never forgot because it so coincided. And some of you might have heard it before. It's a story about the miners in Dynek, Montana, and this is about the 1850s. I don't know. I think it was around 1853, 1854. The second largest gold rush and silver strike in the United States of America was outside of Bannock, Montana. And I may get the names wrong. It's been a while since I've read the story. You can look it up on the internet. Bannock, Montana, and the internet was a place called Alden Creek or Grasshopper Gulch. I get it mixed up. There were two of them there. They were side by side or something like that. And it was discovered by about 6 miners. One of them was a guy named Bill Fairweather, and there was a Henry Edgar and a bunch of other guys. And the story sort of goes like this. It's a true story. You know, this was after the California Gold Rush, and it had sort of run out, and apparently there was this place called Bannock, Montana in the Black Hills, and the Black Hills belonged to the Indians. It was set off for the Indians. You know, white men weren't allowed to go up there, and somebody had discovered some, you know, gold or something in the Black Hills, and so a whole mining town developed in Bannock, Montana. You know, you've heard about Virginia City and everything like that, and what happened was these miners, about 300 or 400 miners, and they all went up, you know, they violated the law, they went into the Black Hills to search for gold and silver, and there were these 7 miners, and 2 of the miners were Bill Fairweather and Henry Edgar, I used to know the other names, and they were sort of lagging behind. So 300 guys went up to the Black Hills, and where they weren't supposed to go, and these 7 other miners went with them, went behind them. They were about a day behind them, and they got captured by the Crow Indians. And they actually escaped from the Crow Indians, except for one guy who actually, it didn't matter, it's not that he didn't escape, he stayed behind. And that's a whole other story, but they made their way back towards Bannock in order to get more supplies, and they camped by a riverbed by a place called Alden's Gulch. And while they were camped by this riverbed in this place called Alden's Gulch, Henry Edgar, one of the miners, saw some rim rock, and he went up there with like a little hammer, and he started, you know, hammering at it. You know, he's a miner, a prospector. And as he was hammering at it, he found some gold. And so the other miners came back, and they started doing a little work, and they worked on it for about 2 or 3 hours, and they came up with what nowadays would be a couple of $1,000 worth of gold. Now, you know, for about 2 hours' work. Now, I want you to sort of like imagine how you would feel if you went in your backyard and, you know, and picked up a scoop, a handful of dirt, and like it was worth like a couple of $1,000. I mean, you'd be pretty excited. They were pretty excited because they knew they had hit something. But they also knew there were all these miners around. They didn't want the claim to be jumped. They had to go in there, register. They had to do a couple things, and they had to mine the thing, and they had to get supplies. So they made a pact. And the pact was they would go back to Bannock, and they would regroup and get supplies, and then they scurry on out of there and meet by the old oak tree or some tree out there. And the whole idea was, he says, nobody would say anything to anybody about what they found. And that was the deal. And they swore a blood oath, and that was it. And so they went into Bannock, Montana, and they got their supplies. They got out of there, and as they were walking to the oak tree, leading their horses, they looked behind them, and there's about 200 or 300 miners right behind them, following them. And so, I mean, their hearts dropped. You know, obviously, they realized somebody had spilled the beans. You know, somebody had talked. And so when they got to the tree and everything, and the leader went up to the leader of the other miners, and he wanted to know. He said, who talked? I mean, who's? He says, nobody. He said, nobody spoke. He says, what do you mean nobody spoke? He says, we could see it in your eyes. We could see it in your eyes. We knew you had hit the mother load. We knew you had hit the mother load. Their excitement was so extraordinary, they couldn't keep it off their faces. Even if they shut up, you couldn't hide it. They knew they had hit the mother load. And out of that mine, in the 20 or 30 or 40 years after that, there were hundreds of millions of dollars in gold and silver that was taken out of Alden's Creek, out of that mine. I want to read you something. In Alcoholics Anonymous number 3, which is testimony, really, it's a story. It says our stories disclose, in a general way, what we used to be like. You remember in the first part when they talk about what an AA talk is all about, on page 29 of the big book, it says the following. It says, further on, clear-cut directions are given showing how we recover. These are followed by 43 personal experiences. Each individual, in the personal stories, describes in his own language and from his own point of view the way he established his relationship with God. It's that relationship. It says, see to it that your relationship is right, and great events will come to you and other people, will happen. It's that relationship which brings back, that's the mother load. That brings on the mother load. That's the deal. It's the relationship. Job or no job, wife or no wife, let no alcoholic say that he needs his wife or family back in order to recover. Nonsense. Trust God and clean house. It all depends upon his relationship with God. It's all about that relationship that brings forth the mother load. And our promises, and the reason I talk about the promises, the 9th step, right after the 9th step, it says that's when the promises happen. You know what it says? After all these incredible promises the new freedom, the new happiness. You know, the rocket in the fourth dimension, he says, we will slowly see that God is doing for us. Does it say that good orderly direction is doing for us? That doing the right thing is doing for us? That great works is doing for us? You know, that a lot of knowledge or being smart is going to a lot of meetings is doing for us? That God is doing for us that which we could not do for ourselves. He is the transforming deal. The God of our understanding is the transforming deal. He's the one who does this deal. Okay? And I think every meeting we go to, it says there is one who has all power, power to change you. That one is God. May you find him now.
Yes.
Not may you dream him up, or may you make him up, or may you sort of figure out what you want to do. May you find him now. And you know what happens if you find him? Evidence of you finding him and have a relationship with him is experiencing much of heaven and being rocketed in the fourth dimension of existence of which you had not even dreamed. You know why I know that's evidence of it? Because in our book, Alcoholics Anonymous, it says right here, when it talks about that chapter, it says, we have found much of heaven and we have been rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence of which we had not even dreamed. The great fact is just this and nothing less. Which I think means that the great fact is just this, you ready for this, and nothing less. You know, sometimes the book just means what it says. You know, later on in the book where it talks about God being, he is the Father, we are his children, he says, this is the archway of freedom. It says, this is the how and why of it. It says, the book says the same thing. I don't know if you know this. The book says the same thing over and over and over again in different ways. And the reason it does that is because alcoholics are not bright. Well, I mean, we're brilliant, but we're stupid. It's sort of like a stupid brilliance, you know what I mean? It's like we're absolutely brilliant, but we destroy people and we destroy ourselves, you know? It's not a brilliant thing to use alcohol to destroy your life and the lives of others. But we certainly can do a lot of math and, you know, earn money. We can do a lot of things. We can be stars. We can be singers. We can be dancers. But we're just, as human entities, we're absolute abject failures. About feeling good about ourselves and helping. We're abject failures. On a worldly basis, as far as the world is concerned, we can be great CEOs. We can get MBAs, you know. We can get Juris Doctorates, you know. You can graduate. You can make a lot of money. But as human entities on the face of the earth trying to help it, we can be just absolute abject failures. The great fact is just this and nothing less. The great fact is just this and nothing less, that we have had deep and effective spiritual experiences which have revolutionized our whole attitude towards life, towards our fellows, and towards God's universe. The central factor of our lives today. Oh, they use some very interesting words. You know, for people like us, who, I don't know about you, I'm a former New Yorker. I really am a former New Yorker. I'm not like a New Yorker, I'm a former New Yorker. But if you hang around New Yorkers, they're very difficult to talk to. Because, you know, you've got to get your thoughts across in 3 seconds. The only thing about New Yorkers, you start talking, by the third word, you say, get to the point. What's the point? You know, what's the point already? You know, I mean, unfortunately, sometimes the point takes more than 2 words. You know what I mean? Because they're impatient. You know, what's the point? What's the bottom line? When they use words like the great fact, the central fact, you know, I mean, you're reading through this whole book, it's 164 pages, and they're saying the great fact, the central fact, these are things you got to pay attention to. The great fact is this and nothing less, that we have had deep and effective spiritual experiences which have revolutionized our whole attitude towards life, towards our fellow, and towards God's universe. The central fact of our lives today, what's the central fact? Well, I can promise you this, and I'm not putting down AA. I love AA. I love being in AA. But I'll tell you what, you know, you start talking too much about the central fact in AA, you'll have your critics. They don't want to hear about the central fact. They want to have meetings on relationships. You know, in AA, when they say let's have a meeting on relationships, you know they're not talking about God. You know, they're not talking about, as a matter of fact, if you talk too much about God in AA, you're going to get a bad, you know, they want to talk, have a meeting about romantic relationships. I don't know how to tell you this. AA is not about romantic relationships. You know, see to it that your relationship with God is right, and you'll have great relationships with everybody. If your relationship with God isn't right, you're not going to have a decent relationship with another human being, ever, including yourself. AA is about developing a relationship with God, and relationships with other people, decent relationships, and practicing principles in your life, and building character. It's really not about getting laid. No, it really isn't. It really isn't. I know some people think it is. You know, it's, you know, gateway to happiness or something like that. It's not about that. The central fact of our lives today is the absolute certainty that our Creator has entered into our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. He has commenced to accomplish those things for us which we could never do by ourselves. He has commenced to accomplish those things for us which we could never do for ourselves. He does it. Who is He? Well, you know, I hope you develop a relationship with Him. Because whoever He is, you better find Him, because He's the one who's going to do it for you. And that sounds awful like what they say at the end of the promises, right? He is doing for us what we cannot do for ourselves. It also sounds very much like what they say at the end of the vision for you, where it says, "See to it that your relationship with Him is right, and great events will happen for you and countless others come to pass." It says this: God will constantly disclose more to you. Ask Him in your morning meditation. You know something? He is actually even going to show you how to create the fellowship you crave. So, I mean, how important is this stuff? I mean, I know it's throughout the book, and it says the great fact is this, no matter, and nothing less, and here's the how and why of it. We had to quit playing God. He's the Father, you know, and all this sort of stuff. When we finally accept this, we'll lose fear of today, tomorrow, and the hereafter. We'll be wrong. I know how, this is all important, but how important is this in this terms of experiencing much of heaven? In Alcoholics Anonymous number 3, on page 191, this is Bill Dotson's story. Bill Dotson, anybody see? I don't even know if they have it hanging here. They have it hanging in a lot of A rooms. Do they have the man on the bed hanging in here? If you go to A rooms sometimes, you'll see a photograph. I don't know how many people have ever seen an oil painting, a photograph of two guys. One of them is holding the Bible. That's what it is. It is in the big book. And there's a guy sitting on a bed that, you know, sort of like in a t-shirt and looking kind of disheveled. That's the man on the bed. That's the first two alcoholics, a rendition, talking to Bill Dotson, Alcoholics Anonymous number 3. Before the big book was written, when they walked in there with the Bible, you know, that's the deal. And this is Bill Dotson's story. His story is still in the big book. It's in the third edition. It's the fourth edition. It's called Alcoholics Anonymous number 3. And this is what he says in his story. And I guess he wrote this when he had, I don't know, 15 years sobriety or something like that. I'm not sure. But he's talking about when he first met Bill Wilson. And this is what he says. It says, "It would be hard to estimate how much AA has done for me. I really wanted the program, and I wanted to go along with it. I noticed that others, you know how it says in the big book? If you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps." You know, apparently there's a step before the steps. There really is. I mean, I'm not just making this up. It says, if you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. You know, some people just ain't ready. You know, you may want what we have, but you may not be willing to go to any lengths. You know, an AA willing to go to any length is not climbing up Mount Everest. I know that's what we think it is. Willing to go to any length is maybe going to a meeting on a Tuesday night when that's the night you usually stay home and watch American Idol. Willing to go to any length sometimes means something like not texting during meetings. You know, for alcoholics, willing to go to any length is like a very low bar. No, I'm serious. It's like a very, very low bar. I know we think willing to go to any length is like, you know, like crawling to an AA meeting when your legs are broken. That's not willing to go. Willing to go to any length is like really going to a meeting like on a Thursday. You know what I mean? It's like doing small stuff when you really want to do something else. Okay? And some people really want what we have, but they're not willing to go to any other. They want what they have, but they're just not willing to give up their girlfriend or their job in the bar or whatever it is. And some people don't want what we have. I know that's hard for you to believe. Some people just really don't want what we have. They're sitting in an A meeting, and they're looking at their watches, you know, and they're saying, I can't believe this guy's still talking. You know, I got to get home because I got American Idols on or something, because they got better things to do. They got to get out of here. They're just putting in the time. They're trying to. They don't want what we have. They don't want anything that's going on in here. They just want to get back in the bed. They want something. They want their wife back. They want their husband back. They want the kids back. They want the money back. They want the job back. They may want to even stop drinking for a while, but they don't want what we have. They don't want that. They ain't seeing nothing in anybody's eyes in here. They ain't like those miners following those guys in the street saying we knew you would hit the mother load. They don't think the mother load's in here. They think the mother load's out there. They're chasing stuff out there. They don't want what we have. But for those who want what we have, whoever we are, and I guess in order to want what we have, you got to have a we. Do you have a we? Do you have people in here that you look up to? I mean, not that you put people on pedestals, but you know, hey, you know, the truth of the matter is this is a program of action that has to do with following other people in front of you. I mean, I'm going to tell you, I had my AA heroes. I had my people in front of me that I wanted what they had. I had some stuff going on, and I was looking at these guys. Just like, you know, what he says in here is exactly what happened to me. That's why it's important to me, because his story is exactly, it matches my story. So I know it's something, so if his story matches my story, and I used to think I was unique, then chances are I'll bet there are other people that feel the same way. You know, whenever I see somebody in my life, and it could be an AA, it could be out of AA, it could be just a pastor, you know, or somebody who, you know, loves the Lord, or who I am looking up to, they never, whenever they're telling their testimony, there's always other men or women in their testimony that brought them to where they are, or helped them get that they admired and they looked up to, and brought the message to them. You know what I mean? They never get there alone. So there's already some person that interceded in their lives, you know, that represented where God worked through that person. And I guess that's why it's about we're being of maximum service to God and other people. It says it would be hard to estimate how much AA had done for me. I really wanted the program and I wanted others to go along with it. Now you see, he wanted what we have. Who was his we? His we at that time was Dr. Bob and Bill Wilson. That was Dr. Bob and Bill Wilson. You know, I had my we. I had men in my life, you know, mostly men. There were some women, but men in my life that, man, I wanted to hang out with them. I wanted what they have. It says, this is what he says. I noticed that others, remember how I started this off by saying, have you experienced much of heaven? And have you been rocketed into the fourth dimension of existence of which I had not even you had not even dreamed? Listen to what he says. He says, I noticed that others seemed to have such a release, a happiness, a something that I thought a person ought to have. I was trying to find the answer. I knew there was even more, something that I hadn't got. And man, I knew that. Listen, I was in AA. I was not drinking. I was on that pink cloud. I experienced all the happiness and joy and everything that happens when one day in your life you're saying, I can never stop drinking. I'm a failure. My life is over. I can't ever experience a life without drinking. And one day I'm not drinking. And the next day I'm not drinking. I'm not even thinking about not drinking. And all of a sudden I feel good about myself. And people are putting their arms around me. And I'm like, I feel like I'm rocketing in the fourth dimension, some sort of fourth dimension. And then, not that everything crashed down, but all of a sudden like I'm experiencing life on life's terms. I'm in hand-to-hand combat with all the crazies out there. And, you know, there's AA, you know, which is my safe haven. And then there's earth people, you know, who are out to get me, and you know, saying, I mean, you know, I'm loving AA, I'm doing good. I mean, I thought my sobriety was great and everything was well, you know, in between going crazy, you know what I mean? And I go to a meeting and I feel good, and I walk out of a meeting and I feel bad, and I go to a meeting and I feel good, and I walk out of a meeting and I feel bad, and you know, that's the way it was for the first 15, 20 years, you know what I mean? And you know, give or take, you know, everything was great. AA was great. I was enjoying. Everything was wonderful, except for the times that I felt like killing myself. You know, other than that, everything was okay. You know what I mean? I mean, it wasn't a bad thing. I mean, if it was all that bad, or if I thought, I guess I would have been drinking again. Obviously, it was good enough to keep me coming back for more, and I thought it was as good. But, you know, I wasn't realizing what the deal, I wasn't realizing what they were talking in here. It was almost like priming the, you know, I got a pool. And on this pool, I'll tell you, my next house, I'm not going to get a pool. I think I'm going to live in a Chevy or something. But in any event, I got this pool that's got a pump. You know, anybody ever prime a pump? It's like all of a sudden the pump is working, then the pump's not working. The pump is working, then the pump's not working. The pump is working, then the pump's not working. You got to prime the pump. You know what? I think for 10 or 15 years in this program, you're like, God was priming the pump. It would be working, and then it wasn't working. And then it was working, and then it wasn't working. And then it was working, and then it wasn't working. And some sponsor would come along and prime the pump, and then it would work for a while. And then it would stop working. And then it was working, and it was not working. I said, when is this going to stop? When am I going to have to stop dealing with the anxiety and the this and the that and the guilt and all the crap and the drama of all the people around me, you know, and it's and that kind of stuff. And I'm reading this book about people who have been rocking in the fourth dimension of existence, you lose fear of people and effort, economic insecurity, you know, when's that going to happen to me? When am I going to stop worrying about money? When am I going to stop being a thumb-sucking crybaby? When am I going to stop complaining? When am I going to stop having that? When am I going to stop having to go to AA meetings to get a fix? I mean, nothing wrong with going to AA meetings to get a fix, but I mean, when am I going to start living my life to live my life and feel excited about my life all the time and go to AA meetings because I want to help other people because I love other people and I miss other people and being happy, joyous, and free? When am I going to stop having to go to other meetings like I need to, like, when am I going to stop doing AA in meetings like I need to take a drink? You know? When am I going to have to stop calling my sponsor and doing all this stuff because I need to do it because I need... It's the same thing as drinking. Listen, it's not the same thing as drinking. You understand what I'm saying? Because the hangover's different. But the bottom line is, and they can't arrest you for driving while, you know, it was serene. But the bottom line is, you know, it's sort of like the same thing. You're feeling kind of crappy, so you go to a meeting, and then you feel good, and then you go, you call the sponsor, you feel you're constantly having to throw things into yourself to feel better and prop yourself up because you're so, you're just not connected without the deal. You got to be constantly priming the pump. When is that going to stop? Never. I thought it was never going to stop. But then again, I thought I'd never stop drinking too. And I felt like this guy. It says, I really wanted the program. I wanted to go along with it. I noticed that others seemed to have such a release, a happiness, something that I thought a person ought to have. Because thank God I saw people in here. I ran into people in here that they were, look, I was physically sober. You understand? I was picking up the medallions, okay? I mean, that's what AA is about, right? Picking up the medallions. I was picking up the medallions. I was sober. But, I was sober. And there would be other people, like Bob Sullivan, like Joe Snyder, like Ray O'Keefe, like all the other people in my life, you know, like Marge LePere. And I was sober, and they were sober, but there was something else going on with them. They were at a different, they were sucking some different drug. They were on some different drug than I was on. They were on a different level. You know, you ever run into somebody that, you know, they're an AA, you're an AA, they're an alcoholic, you're an alcoholic, but you know there's something going on with them that ain't going on with you? Yeah, I mean, just know. This, you know, like they hit the mother load. You know, so you're trying to figure out the secret. You know, I used to do this. I used to go to meetings all the time. I'd follow these guys around. I'd go to different AA meetings, or go to the so-and-so's doing this stuff. Because I knew if I sat in the front row and I listened to these guys, I was going to get the secret. Yeah, they were going to see something. I was going to get the secret. And I was going to be just like them. You know what I mean? And this is what it says. It says, I noticed that others seemed to have such a release, a happiness, of something I thought a person ought to have. I was trying to find the answer. That was me. I was trying to find the answer so I could get what they had just like that. I knew there was even more, something I hadn't gotten. And I remember one day, a week or two after I'd come out of hospital, Bill was over to my house talking to my wife and me. We were eating lunch and I was listening and trying to find out why he had this release that they thought that they seemed to have. Bill looked across at my wife and said to her, he didn't even know the guy was listening. This became the bedrock of this guy's life. He's talking to somebody else. He said, Henrietta, the Lord has been so wonderful to me. I don't think he was talking about the doorknob. He says, the Lord has been so wonderful to me. He wasn't talking about good orderly direction. The Lord has been so wonderful to me, curing me of this terrible disease that I just want to keep talking about it and telling other people. I think I have the answer. Bill was very, very grateful that he had been released from this terrible thing and he had given God the credit for having done it. And he's so grateful about it, he wants to tell other people about it. That sentence, the Lord has been so wonderful to me, curing me of this terrible disease that I just want to keep telling people, other people about it, has been a sort of golden text for the AA program and for me. So what does this have to do with step 9? Before the big book was written, as you know, because I've spoken about this before, there were three books that they thought were essential elements in Alcoholics Anonymous. All the steps can be, and the three books, and I'm just, listen, this isn't Dr. Bob and the Good Old Times. You can read it, you can look it up. I'm not going to quote it. It's somewhere here. You ought to get Dr. Bob and the Good Old Times. The three books that they basically, that A basically came from was written in the Bible. That's what they used to study in the Bible. It was the 1 Corinthians 13. It was the book of James. As a matter of fact, we were almost called the James Club. That's how much they were into the book of James. And the third book was something called the Sermon on the Mount, which is in the New Testament, Matthew 5, 6, and 7. It's the only full sermon that Jesus did in the Bible. As a matter of fact, there's a famous book that's passed around the AA for the last 50 years called by Edmund Fox called Sermon on the Mount, which is basically his commentary on the Sermon on the Mount. And all the principles in Alcoholics Anonymous, everything we do here, is lifted from the Bible. And if you read Sermon on the Mount, you'll understand what that is. Or Jesus and the apostles and everybody wrote the Bible lifted everything from Bill Wilson. It's one of the two, okay? Take your choice, okay? It doesn't matter. You know which way you want to go. So the bottom line is, in the Sermon on the Mount, one of the things that's said is, by in an interesting statement, is he says, listen, if you want to have a relationship with God, what does it say in AA? See to it that relationship with him is right and great events to come to pass for you and countless others, which, by the way, is just the takeoff of First Things First, which is a takeoff is seek ye first the kingdom of God and all his righteousness, and all things will be added unto you. It's all the same deal, okay? And so the bottom line is in Sermon on the Mount, one of the things that's said, one of the statements that's said, is this. It says, if you want to have a relationship with God, well, if you're in this deal, if you're reading this book, if this is what, I don't know what fellowship you're in. I mean, you're sitting in an AA room, but that doesn't mean you're an AA. I mean, listen, sometimes I sit in my garage, doesn't mean I'm a Buick, you know what I mean? I mean, I don't even believe that all people that sit in a church are Christians. I mean, I don't believe, listen, just because your feet are here doesn't mean anything. I mean, this is what tells whether or not what you're doing and your actions, who God tells what you're doing. If you're in here and you want what we have and you're doing this stuff, you're talking about developing a relationship with God. I mean, unless you're just coming here and you're saying, I'm just going to do it my way. Which here, guess what? You're perfectly able to do. You're perfectly able to do. So you do it your way and you see whether you're rocking in the fourth dimension of existence and experience all that deal, okay? So if you want a relationship with God, one of the things he says in Sermon on the Mount, it says, and you come to the altar, you want a relationship with me, and you have a problem with your brother. You have a problem with your brother. Hey, you fix up that problem with your brother first. You take care of that deal first and then come back to me. In other words, you clear up that deal you have with him. The amends you owe with him, the reconciliation you owe. If you want to be reconciled to me, you reconcile yourself to your brother. I mean, in other words, the proof is in the pudding. You know, in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, there's a lot of talking, you know, but when all is said and done, there'll be a lot more said than done in AA. I'll tell you, where you see the evidence of AA happen is when people go up to other people and say, I was wrong. I was wrong and I apologize. You know, here's your money. Or stuff like that. Stuff that really, you know, you have some skin in the game. And so if you look at that and you understand that Alcoholics Anonymous, when you look at the steps, you're going to see the Sermon on the Mount and the dictates and that play out in the steps in order so you'll get a new relationship. Because at the end of the steps, you're going to wind up on where? Step 11. Which is going to be improving your conscious contact with God through prayer and meditation. And step 12, where you're constantly trying to, you know, get better and then carry that message and having that spiritual awakening. It's all about developing that relationship with God and making that relationship even greater, which has to do with fixing that deal up. I was divorced when I was, so long ago. I've been married 30 years, but my first wife was married to her 5 years, nice gal. Wonderful gal, and had a beautiful son, great kid. I guess he's like 36, 37 now. And I have a great relationship with all my kids now, and thanks to this program and the God of my understanding. And when I was divorced, though, when he was like 5 or 6 or 7 years old, something like that. And I was living in my bachelor pad in Carl Gables and doing my thing, you know, trying to find happiness by dating or buying cars or making money or whatever the heck you try to do when you're young and you're trying to look for the answers in all the wrong places. And I was supposed to pick him up one, I don't know, it was a Saturday or Sunday morning. It was my time for visitation. And I had been out that night, the night before, with some gal named Sally. Gotten drunk, you know, as usual, you know, drinking and stuff like that. And I woke up that Saturday and I told my son for weeks that I was going to take him to the zoo, pick him up at 10 o'clock and take him to the zoo. I guess my son was about 6 or 7 years old. And as I'm getting ready to go to the zoo and getting dressed to pick him up, whatever it is, I get a phone call from Sally. And she says to me the following. She says, hey, you know, Russell, myself and the girls are going down in the boat. And they want to know whether you want to come. And so, you know, I was called upon to make a decision. Never let it be said that alcoholics have a problem making a decision. Okay? You know, so here we go. You say, my son, you know, who I promised to take to the zoo, you know, 6 years old, you know, waiting for me, or Sally, the girls, and drinking, and the boat. My son, or Sally. My son, or Sally with the booze. I mean, I probably wrestled with that, I don't know what, 15 seconds? It was anchors away. Now, I would have called him up. I would have called my son up and told him I wasn't coming. I don't know whether it just slipped my mind, honestly, or I thought his mother would probably tell him or he'd figure it out. But I know one thing. I know when I was on the boat drinking the beer, you know, I know I was thinking this. I remember thinking this, that I'm actually doing him a favor. See, let me tell you something. When you're an alcoholic, and especially when you're a really smart alcoholic, and I was a good lawyer, you can talk yourself into anything because I could rationalize. In other words, I could tell myself rational lies. And I said, you know, he's not going to like hanging around with me. He's going to like better with that. You know, I'm drinking this booze, you know, because when you live the life I live, you better drink. And I'm thinking, that I'm doing him a favor while he's sitting there waiting for his father who's never going to come. You know, and I'm going to tell you something. I wasn't a criminal, and I'd never been arrested, and I was a lawyer, and I was all this and that, and I wore a three-piece suit. But, you know, deep down inside, you know what I was? I was a bum. I was a bum. That's exactly what it was, an absolute bum, a failure as a human being, because that's what bums do. They're irresponsible. They hurt other people. They hurt little children. They're irresponsible. They have no integrity, and they care only about themselves. And I was a bum in a three-piece suit. And I may have drank, and I may have drank because I needed a drink. You know something? I don't blame alcohol for anything. I don't blame anything I did on alcohol because most of the bad decisions, the most hurtful things, and the greedy and selfish things I did to people, I did cold stone sober. You know, and the truth of the matter is, the only thing alcohol did for me is help me live with my sorry self while I was doing it, and being able to tell myself the lies that it was okay or they deserved it. But you want to know something? Deep down where I lived, in my heart, you know, it's like the portrait of Dorian Gray, where, you know, there's some portrait down there, and every time I hurt somebody, like my son, or I misbehaved, or I did something, it's like somebody put a black mark on that portrait. You know, and by the time I was 26, 27, 30 years old, that portrait was all marked up with black stuff. And nobody knew what a worthless piece of crap I was than me. You know, I may have told you in the bar, I don't care what other people think about me. Or I may have told you I was a great guy, or whatever I would have told myself. But deep down inside, I knew what a worthless bum I was, which is why I couldn't look you in the eye, which is why I was so sensitive. Because nobody knew, you know, they say, what do they say, egomaniacs with inferiority complex? I don't know about that, but I knew what a bum I was. I'd have to drink myself city to feel okay about myself. I felt worthless. And the reason I felt worthless is because I was worthless. I was worthless. There was nothing good about me. There was nothing decent about me. You know, what I was told is when I come to AA, and you know something? I don't know how to explain this to you, but in AA, that's why I like AA, because you don't have to explain a lot. I don't know whether you know what it's like, and I guess most of you know, to go through life feeling you're not good enough. You know, just comparing your insides with other people's outsides and knowing that deep down inside you're not good enough, and that somehow if they look in your eyes, they'll see who you really are, and you know, sort of like find out the truth, and being scared and knowing you're, you know, and all that sort of stuff we walk around with, which makes it impossible to have relationships with other people, and being hypersensitive and all that sort of stuff and touchy, and you know, not being able to do stuff like this or talk about stuff like this, you know, because you're so scared they're going to find out what you're really about and everything like that. And, being ashamed, walking around with shame and all that sort of stuff, and guilt, you know? But to live your life that way, you know how lonely you feel, how alone you feel, how you can never really be solid or open with anybody, and then have to worry about, you know, what other people think about you all the time, and if you see someone in the street, when you're going somewhere to a party, is he going to be there, is she going to be there, what's going to happen if she shows up, what if they say this, what if they say that? You know, if the phone rings, what if it's him? What if it's them? Should I open up the envelope or not open up the envelope? I mean, the crap that you have to go through because you're such a piece of crap. You know what I mean? And live your life that way and then have to drink at the same time just to be almost okay because you know you're a nothing, you know, and you're always going to be a nothing. So you throw something in your stomach to make you an almost because almost when you're nothing, almost is top of the world. I mean, that kind of crap, you know, live your life like that all alone. It's like a horror story. And to come in here and to be able to slowly, you know, being able to take those black marks off the portrait, sort of erase those black marks off the portrait. I mean, it took 10 years to put them, 10, 15 years to put them things on. And all of a sudden go down there with Windex and slowly but surely wipe this black mark off, like watch that black mark off. So then you wake up one day and you're not worried about running into anybody on the planet Earth. You're not worried about apologizing to anybody for anything. You're unconcerned whether anybody finds out anything about you. You understand? You can be open. You can come to AA meetings and you can talk without notes, you know, and you're not worried about what you might say or what you might not say or what people might think or what they might not think, because you could be you. You could be you. I don't even have to be somebody I think you'll like. I could just be me. You know what I mean? And even if I'm mean and you don't like me, at least you don't like me, you know, instead of not liking somebody I'm pretending to be. So I have to track you down and say, I know you don't like me, but it's not me. It's really, I'm actually somebody else, you know? And I was just making leave to be him. I'm really me, you know, or something like that. And you know how much easier it is to be you and then to actually like you and feel good about you. So you wake up in the morning, you don't feel like you're a bum. You feel like you're God's handiwork and you can help other people. Feel like you're experiencing much of heaven and being rocking in the fourth dimension. You know what that's like? Do you have an idea what it's like to live that way? You want to miss that deal? You want to go through life from cradle to grave and not have that deal and say, well, at least I didn't drink, you know, and miss that other stuff? You want to walk out with a ham sandwich and not have the, you know, the lobster? You don't want that deal. That's what these steps are all about. And that's what allows God's grace to come in and reconcile you to other people and reconcile you to Him so you can have, like, a clear conscience. Nothing better like than a clear conscience. I don't know how many people in here are going to go to sleep tonight thinking about people. I know if you're an alcoholic, I know there's some alcoholics in here that are right now, or maybe not right now, but when they drive away, they're going to be thinking about people, or a person, or a thing, or a situation that they can't get out of their mind. You don't want to really spend the rest of your life like that. So thank you. God bless you. I'll see you next week.